On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
We are joined in studio by Sinead O'Carroll, editor of thejournal.ie, and by Gerard Howland, who's a columnist with the Sunday Times and a public affairs consultant. And before we deal with any of the stories that are on the front pages, Gerard, you yourself have written quite a touching piece in today's Sunday Times reflecting on your memories of the late Desi O'Malley, who died this week.
Well, I was a 20-year-old student on the periphery of the foundations of the Progressive Democrats in December 85, but I was there in that back room at 25 South Frederick Street when it happened. Were we 50, 60 people in that room? I'm not quite sure.
And it remained before social distancing, obviously.
Obviously, well before social distancing or the banning on smoking or any of those things that were to come. But it was a moment that really inspired me. A lot of things fade in life, excitement and heroes have feet of clay. Mm. O'Malley was clearly imperfect in many ways, but he remains for me undimmed, a real hero. It was a moment, people forget the context of 1985. Mm. The place was beyond miserable. We had the first population decline in 85 in a generation.
Wow.
About 70-odd thousand people had emigrated since 81, according to the 86 census. Two-thirds of the majority of the people had voted to put in the Eighth Amendment in 83. In 85, 63% voted against divorce. In the last general election of November 82, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and Labour combined got about 92% of the vote. There was a sense... Average unemployment during those 80s was 16%. There was a real sense that the country was sinking and suffocating. And if you weren't there and you can't remember it, you're not really ever going to quite understand it. All these jokes in college, I was a student in Trinity, I'd send the last one out, turn out the lights. It was the time when Gay Byrne made the famous quip, half in jest, half in earnest, in a hot press interview, you know, that so we should hand the country back to the Queen of England with a letter of apology for the state it was in. There was a shocking demoralisation. And apart from all that economic misery, there was the overhang of Northern Ireland, which was brutal. Mm. Atrocities were daily. And a really deep belief that it was an impenetrable, insolvable morass.
And how does the PDs, the role of the PDs and the role of Des O'Malley fit into all of that? Because again, as someone who didn't experience all of that firsthand, you struggle to deal with, have some empathy for just how grim it was. But also maybe we don't quite understand how merely forming a new political party helps to address all of the above.
Well, no new political party had been formed, I suppose, going back to the 40s and 50s since Clan na Publicta. It seemed impossible. He, when he was expelled from Fianna Fáil, was a hero to some, but he was also seemingly completely cornered. Maybe he could hold a seat in Limerick East, but what more could he do? And MacDougall and Harney in particular prevailed upon him, and he was very reluctant, I think, in the end, to form a new party. The odds were apparently insuperable. But there was, and this is my experience, I mean, I say a phone bank, were there half a dozen phones? People forget how difficult it was to get a landline. Mm. And there were no mobiles. Mm-hmm. The fax was the most sophisticated means of communication. And these half dozen phones were hopping. And then you'd put people on to O'Malley and say, good morning. How are you?
Yeah. And they were shocked. It would be O'Malley himself picking up the phone and answering O'Malley, these phone calls.
And you'd be picking up the phone and you'd be talking to Gavin O'Reilly and he'd be giving you his name and address because he wanted to join up and help. And then you'd say, Gavin O'Reilly, and you'd hand the phone to O'Malley and good morning, Gavin, how are you? Yeah.
That's a way to put people
it
up.
It was
yeah.
very funny. And these monster meetings where vast crowds came, the one in Galway in particular when Bobby Molloy walked on stage to join the new party. But the euphoria passed. There were two general elections. And within 4 years of his founding that party in that small, packed, not socially distant room, he had bent Charles Haughey to his will. He had brought Fianna Fáil, with great reluctance on both sides and a great deal of suspicion, into a coalition government. Fianna Fáil never ruled alone again.
Yeah.
And from that moment is the long trajectory to the general election of 2011, when the mould was broken into smithereens. Mm. But O'Malley was the man who fractured it in that moment.
I will get Sinead to talk about a piece that Owen O'Malley, Desi Sun and a regular contributor at this show, has written today in the Sunday Independent. I'll come back to that in a minute. But just before we do that, Ger, just because you kind of lived through all of that, I kind of made a remark during the week, but even still, I don't even fully understand the import or the impact of it. That even nowadays it's very difficult as a parliamentarian to leave your party, and that it is slightly more the dumb thing. There's maybe more of a beaten track to do it, but it's still very newsworthy, and it's a very big gesture for anyone to decide to leave the party that they might have been at home in for years or for a generation. But particularly more so in the 1980s, because it wasn't the dumb thing, and because Fianna Fáil was so domineering and dominant and very inclusionary if you were within the fold, but very exclusionary if you weren't. So the idea of the gesture that he made of leaving and setting up a new party, significant as it would be even these days, back in the mid-1980s, was anathema to so many people.
Well, it's apparently unthinkable. It was treachery, because these parties went back three generations. The O'Malleys were three generations in Fianna Fáil politics in Limerick by that stage. He, Des O'Malley, when he first received his seal of office as Minister of Justice, received it from the hands of De Valera. So there was literally an apostolic succession. And Fianna Fáil in government, the single party government for most of the time, it was the political embodiment of the nation. You cannot think of that party, except in hindsight, as just a political party. It was a movement that had the apparatus of a party, but it was the embodiment of the nation in its own
it
terms.
It must have been then seen as being almost, in a funny way, given what Des O'Malley had to deal with as Minister for Justice, it must also then have been seen as almost subversive to the state to decide to try and undermine Fianna Fáil.
Because Fianna Fáil was the embodiment, not of so much of the state as of the Republic. And this is why, firstly, his stance in relation to the New Ireland Forum, his opposition to Haughey's view on that, and Mary Harney's, by the way, her kicking out of Fianna Fáil, was it a walkout or a kicking out? I forget the detail, but her out of Fianna Fáil was based on her refusal to join Haughey and Fianna Fáil in voting against the Anglo-Irish Agreement. And if you again look at the long trajectory of history, it was that Hume, Harney, O'Malley vision, where O'Malley, you know, that famous speech of I Stand By the Republic, that was about pluralism. And pluralism in the mid-80s was a much-used word. But what really infuriates me, by the way, in the context of the Repeal the Eighth and the same-sex marriage referendum, and people talk about the church and this and that, I was there. I personally saw two-thirds of the majority of people, women and men, not just vote for this, they were bawling for it.
But this is a response to Groundswell.
And similarly in relation to divorce. I mean, this was the visceral view of the great majority of the people. And the owl nonsense that peddled in the last two or three years that this was somehow imposed on us. What a lie.
Well, you're
in the middle of it, by the way, you know, you'd want to be very careful, because this was rough politics.
Well, I suppose it's often said, Sinead, isn't it, that if politicians are a few years behind the curve of society, then we might have been a few years late in repealing the Eighth Amendment or in allowing same-sex marriage. But I suppose the same has to be true of the 1980s, that if the Eighth was legislated for in the first place, it must have been because the public were so far ahead.
And by the way, on same-sex marriage, Ciarán Rose, the activist with Glenn, I mean, he's just republished stuff. People were being arrested, gay men and perhaps some women were being arrested in the 1980s and charged.
Yeah. It's not, like, too long ago at all.
These were our parents, and people, certainly not your age, but my age, who were voting, upholding, sustaining this.
It's a thread that Justine McCarthy pulls on in her piece on the same page as yours, Jared, in the Sunday Times today, and some kind of less often quoted things from Des O'Malley, because she's makes the point that the PDs were often derided for abandoning one of their founding aims, which was to erase references to God from the Constitution. So I think, Jared, probably to look at what you're saying about, you know, society had its part, but, you know, the church was so inextricable from so many aspects of society, probably leads into the things that she remarks on that were happening at the time, like Joanne Hayes and the Kerry Babels Tribunal. But then she goes on to say, you know, that famous I Stand By the Republic line, but she also adds a line that would have still resonates today. He says the politics of this would have been very easy. This is in explaining why he would not bring himself to oppose wider availability of contraceptives. The politics of this would have been very easy. The politics would be to be one of the lads, the safest way in Ireland. And you know, we're talking about 1985, but there's a lot of that that still feels like pretty like correct in 2021. Then later on, she talks about our parochial and parish pump politics, which we know is still a real problem with how to actually get things done in the national interest here. And she talks about O'Malley saying in 2012, up in Glenties and Donegal, our present system appears to throw up an increasing number of parochial ward healers who have no interest whatever in the national interest. So kind of taking a couple of things that, you know, he was recognising back in the 80s, recognising in the like latter parts of his career, and still very much ring true in 2021.
Mm. Yeah, I think one thing which stands out from all that's written about him today, and indeed everything that was said during the week, is that in a time where there was a lot of careerists in politics, that although he did make a fine career out of it, but at the same time, Des O'Malley didn't enter politics for a career. He entered politics, and power was the means for change. It wasn't the means to sorting out himself, Gerard.
Yes, and I think also reflecting on his son on O'Malley's piece in the Sunday Independent and his eulogy at Donnybrook Church on Friday, like, his family bore a huge burden.
Mm.
His late wife, Pat, her family's pub in Omagh was burned out because he was the Minister for Justice that stood up for the provost. They were shuffled around as children from one place to the other. Mm. There was the whole security issues when he was Minister for Justice in the early 70s. But then there was
Regularly stay in the same address in Dublin because they'd be found out.
All of that. But there was a long lifetime afterwards for 20 years when there weren't those same security concerns, but in which their father was largely absent, engrossed in this political melee. And, you know, the political family at home is left to get on with it. And that's a huge contribution or toll or cost, call it what you like. And it's too little recognised. Mm. Not just the O'Malley's, of course, but many others, you know.
If people do have a little bit of time as we approach the summer holidays, if they do want to dig up his memoir published in 2014, Conduct Unbecoming, I only read it recently enough as it happens. It's a very, very entertaining read, and it's very illuminating about all of that. He finishes with the observation about whether he would have ever been an adequate or capable Fianna Fáil leader or Taoiseach, and he says that if he ever were to have made it that high, he wouldn't have lasted very long, because as he saw it, the duty of all of those in politics was sometimes to say things which were uncomfortable or to raise questions which some would like not to be asked. And I think to all of that we can only say, and so say all of us, and long may he rest. There's plenty in the papers to talk about COVID-19, some of the phase that we're now heading into, and whether there are doubts around the returns of schools in even 5 or 6 weeks time. Hashtag on the record NT is our hashtag on Twitter if you want to get in touch this morning. One tweeter says that Gerard is completely right, because even today to mention that society played such a significant part in the ills of the past is met with derision, but our parents and their parents made these decisions to put children in homes and to forcibly adopt their babies. Do let us know what you think. Hashtag on the record NT. Someone else, by the way, has been in touch to suggest that Desi O'Malley was part of a generation of others, politicians who made sure that they were very adequately rewarded for their time in public office. And I think it's also the case that not only did Desi O'Malley forego his pension and gift it back to the state for a long time, but it also is the case back in the 1980s that politicians were not, at least through orthodox means, very well paid for their time in public office. And maybe it's part of that which has led to some suspicion about some certain figures of 1980s politics and how they exactly managed to accrue their wealth, because politics at the time didn't pay too well. Gerard Howland, columnist with the Sunday Times, and Sinead O'Carroll of the Journal.ie are both with me in studio. Sinead, there's a lot written today about COVID and the phase that we're about to head into tomorrow, but also towards the tail end of August and September. You picked out a piece by Hugh O'Connell on page 5 of the Sunday Independent, which perhaps gives rise to some nervousness within Cabinet about what's about to happen.
Yeah, he's been talking to some of his sources, and you know, we are going into this opening up, and obviously it's only one sector opening up. A lot of the opening up has already happened, you know, in the phased way in the last few weeks, but indoor dining is such a big one. I think that people, it's almost like the pictures of, like, we've seen the pictures from the UK of nightclubs. We're not going that far here, but the idea of people being able to break bread on, you know, groups of six, and there obviously won't be masks in those settings. And because it's such an unknown, there's obviously a lot of politicians who are taking these decisions. Cabinet have signed off on it, and we expect the guidelines to be signed off this evening.
Mm.
And they're very nervous that, like, okay, what if we get this wrong? They obviously have the experience of Christmas. There was probably a little bit of nervousness going into Christmas. That was completely, you know, the wrong thing to do. We went into a 6-month lockdown and, you know, 1,000 deaths as a result. So you can understand that nervousness. And you'd wonder then, like, well, should the decision be different?
Yeah.
But it's obviously not, it's not that much nervous.
Actions, should they have acted then?
Yeah. I guess it's because there's so many unknowns, they've decided to go with this. Rachel Lavin has a piece as well in the Business Post, which is quite related, because she's asking, like, you know, a lot of other countries, including the UK, have now just kind of said, right, we're opening up. This is our strategy. We'll not quite let it rip, but almost let it rip. Is that now our strategy too? Because, you know, we have the warning signs, we have the Delta variant, we have the, you know, the case numbers going up every day, but we're still doing it. So is it our strategy now too? It looks like it, probably with a little more caution than we're seeing in other places.
Gerard, your thoughts on that or on any other COVID piece in today's papers?
Just what we are doing here, it's what the UK is doing there, which really matters to us. Because international travel is now opened up. We have a land border with Northern Ireland. And regardless of what we do here, what happens there is going to seep in across our border. So it's the combination of our domestic opening and that context, as well as greater international travel besides the UK. And then we're only weeks away from schools reopening. And that is the ultimate strategic goal of government, to reopen education in the autumn. And I suppose in that context, we know in 2 or 3 weeks whether we are sufficiently vaccinated, the clear dangers of what's happening notwithstanding, to allow us ride this through, reopen education in September and get through the rest of this as people are becoming rapidly vaccinated.
No, but when you mentioned, though, the combination of what we do here and what happens in the UK because of the spillover effect from Northern Ireland, that kind of means that if you were to manage...
direct travel.
And direct travel, true. But if you were to manage things on a purely epidemiological level, then you would say if Northern Ireland or Britain is reopening at a speed quicker than we would like, then we ought to offset that by being more prudent in this part of the world.
Yes, you could say that. And the government,
but what government can do that can govern their affairs in Dublin based on what happens in London. That was a pointed thing that we didn't do for Brexit.
Well,
why would we do it now?
If you're a small country with a much bigger neighbour with whom you share a border, like it or lump it, you have to modulate a lot of what you do with an eye on your larger neighbour. The government's in a bind. There's no clear right or wrong. They'll know in 2 or 3 weeks how this is working. If it goes okay, they'll do okay. And if not, they'll get
blamed. I think that's the big question, isn't it, Gerard? What will people deem okay? Because we are going to be talking about breakthrough infections, hospitalizations and deaths. So what we're really saying is how many deaths are okay. Like, there will be a number of deaths, and I think, you know, in a pandemic some deaths are going to be are going to happen. What we're kind of asking the government to decide is what level of deaths is okay.
Well, can I get you then to rewind a few seconds and say, why do you think that deaths are inevitable? Because presumably the government is only acting this way because the link between case numbers and hospitalisation and ergo ICU and death is so much dramatically weakened by mass vaccination. We now have a situation where close to 70% of people are fully vaccinated. So why would it necessarily leave in death?
Weakened, not gone, though. And I think that's what all the models have said. That's what all the experts have said. I'm not saying it. I don't know enough to say what's the right
one. Well, I suppose what I mean is, if there's going to be a vaccine breakthrough and there's going to be some amount of people for whom vaccination doesn't offer that cover, or who they might be in the 4 or 5% who don't get maximum protection, isn't it the case that eventually the virus is going to catch up with them one way or another? So hospitality or whatever else doesn't matter, because if you go back to having any kind of meaningful reality, or if people go to Croke Park with more than 18,000 people there, if they go and see their friends and family, or if they go and sit indoors somewhere, that eventually the virus is going to find its way back to them. And it's not necessarily social engineering to allow hospitality to be the venue.
Yeah, and I think this is why a lot of people are talking about we need to get to herd immunity before a lot of the restrictions are gone. And that herd immunity figure now is 90%. We had talked before about 70 or 80%. That's 90%, which does bring children into the mix, which is the next big question, which you can see across the papers today as well. You're talking about unvaccinated, but, you know, we have, like Gerard said, we have a huge rate of vaccination now. We've done really well, especially getting people their first doses, but there's still a lot of people who don't have their second doses. There's still a lot of persistently vulnerable people who, even if they have their second doses, are still, you know, immunocompromised in some ways, and they won't get full satisfaction from the vaccine. So I think there is probably still a lot of argument for being cautious, even though the government, as Gerard said, is in a bind. There has to be some kind of ability to open up, particularly when it's happening in other countries. You know, this idea of screaming that Ireland is an outlier is a very strong political argument.
Even
against
if it's becoming
keeping restrictions.
Increasingly untrue, though, because a lot of other countries which originally were more liberally minded than we are, who have now introduced similar requirements where you can only dine indoors if you're vaccinated. Although I suppose there is the scope in those countries that you can take a negative test and then be allowed a certain amount of
time. And I think the difference with those countries
permission.
As well is that they were prepared much earlier. I think the problem here is that we always said we wouldn't do it. You know, the WHO says vaccine passports shouldn't be part of a pandemic solution. And we had said we wouldn't do it. There was no plans to do it. Nothing was put in place very, very early on. In other countries, like Denmark has won, the Dutch, while they had to apologise for opening up too far, some of their indoor dining measures had been working. But they had all that worked out in April and May when we were kind of saying, no, we're not going to open up until enough people are vaccinated. So I think that's a big difference and probably one of the political failings not to be prepared for what has now turned out to be the inevitable.
Good. And Sinead, let's see how it works in the coming week, because there are 120,000 people, I understand, who have double vaccinations, have the piece of paper, but they don't have the digital passport cert. So they're going to be wandering around with bits of paper. Bits of paper, I understand, can be passed between people. It's up to every... venue.
It's an advance in technology we weren't aware of.
Yeah. Not something we had anticipated. You know, how are venues going to double check the piece of paper vis-a-vis people's ID? Then where is the inspectorate for this at 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night? It'll be very few, far between, thin on the ground, by the way, I can absolutely assure you.
Well, if the Health and Safety Authority didn't have enough staff to undertake as many rigorous checks of the likes of meatpacking venues for whatever, then if they're now going to be expected to police every single hospitality venue as well.
We have nothing remotely close to anything adequate. So we're really depending on you know, voluntary
good faith.
And good faith from venues and staff who are hard pressed, and cooperation and politeness from people, which mightn't always be forthcoming after the first jar or two is on board.
And which is in short supply if you talk to any retail staff at the moment.
Indeed, and we've all, I think, heard grumpy people snarling at shop staff and so on, which is not very pleasant. So I think it could be a bumpy week as this all opens up. And where are we in 2 or 3 weeks' time in terms of the hospitalisation numbers? Does that run the risk of undermining the absolute strategic imperative of the schools reopening?
Well, it begs the question then as to why do you think, in all honesty, that the government is acting now on this front? Is it for economic reasons? Is it because they're looking at with one eye on epidemiology and one eye on opinion polls? Or why do it now?
Well, I presume they've one eye on about 6 or 7 big factors, all of those and more. We need to reopen the economy. We need to keep the virus under control. We can't keep borrowing to keep subsidising indefinitely. Going into another year of 2022 would be, on that basis, would be simply unthinkable. All these payments are going to taper out in the new year. No new entrants are being taken on board. So that means people have to have a chance to work. And a lot of venues will not reopen because of a shortage of staff.
Sinead, you have spent, you and your colleagues at thejournal.ie, you've spent so much of the last 16 or 17 months trying to do a certain amount of debunking and fact checking and clarifications of some causes that do the rounds. I wonder what you make of the rally that there was in Dublin yesterday that started at the Custom House, then finished at Merrion Street, anywhere between 2,000 and 5,000 or 10,000 people, depending on who you believe, attending there. A lot of them believing that this and what's about to happen tomorrow is an unprecedented assault on their civil and human rights.
Yeah, and it's because there was very much a mixed crowd, as you said. It was a very big crowd, and people there for a variety of reasons, and you can tell that from the placards. You can tell that from some of the interviews they gave. Some people were there purely because they are anti-vaccination, so people who just don't believe that vaccines should ever be given to anybody. And, you know, there was placards saying medical apartheid and things like that. But then there was a cohort who believed that there's discrimination inherent in allowing one group of people into services while not allowing others. And I think probably one of the issues that I have with this, and why the WHO has an issue with it, is you allow that middle ground to be taken and joined with the anti-vaccination crowd, which is the much more problematic when you talk about what we need for herd immunity with this virus, but also for things like measles, mumps, rubella, stuff that we had, you know, really high levels on, but has gone through the years, HIV or cervical vaccines for girls. So I think HPV vaccine for girls, and that'll now is being rolled out to boys. All of those things. So, you know, anti-vax messages are really dangerous. Allowing them to take up a middle ground is really problematic. And that's what we saw yesterday, because there was a lot of people there yesterday who would be vaccinated, who weren't anti-vax, but who saw real problems with this vaccine.
One of the things that I find slightly more challenging about yesterday, though, as well, is that even if a lot of people assemble there on the purpose of opposing what they see as a vaccine passport or anything like a two-tier society, that would be a legitimate enough concern. But then you have a lot of people on the stage or a lot of other people who were in attendance yesterday who aren't so much concerned at vaccination passports, but rather who just believe that the entire pandemic is made up.
Exactly.
And it's a slight, it's a confluence of two things, or people are mixing and matching where they're not supposed to. But it means that although a lot of those who attend, I'm sure, attend in good faith, a lot of those who organise and who address those are not quite speaking in the same good faith as everyone else.
Exactly. And you're handing power to those people. And also, we were talking earlier about politicians these days. There is a point, like Leo Fracker made today about Twitter, but there is a point that politicians are, you know, it's a very, very difficult job at the moment. And there is absolutely, like in some cases, zero respect and, you know, zero tolerance for people who are working in that space. So, you know, you see death threats, you see on social media, and then people just being incredibly angry against individual people like Tony Holohan, who isn't even, you know, a political figure, and the party leaders in government. So that all kind of mixes to, you know, for an atmosphere that, you know, isn't the same as maybe a understandable, peaceful protest.
Speaking of Twitter and some of the difficulties that politicians have with it, Anthony has been in touch on the Record NT. He says, of course the politicians don't like Twitter because it actually allows genuine people to hit the mark with unpalatable facts about politicians and the government's performance. Eamon says that Leo Varadkar didn't clearly think that Twitter was a sewer when he was suggesting setting up fake accounts to post positive comments about himself and Fine Gael in the course of his leadership campaign, which of course is a very fair point. And speaking of politicians and the use of Twitter, people might have seen that the UK's health secretary yesterday, Sajid Javid, used a tweet which said that Britain could not cower from COVID-19. He's been back on Twitter again inside the last 20 minutes or so. He says that he has deleted the tweet which used the word cower. He was expressing gratitude that the vaccines help us fight back as a society, but it was a poor choice of words and I sincerely apologise. Like many, I have lost loved ones to this awful virus. I will never seek to minimise its impact. Gerd.
Yeah, well, a quick tweet can lead to a lot of long-lasting regret. As I think most people who've ever used Twitter find out. But you make that mistake once or twice and you try and restrain yourself forever thereafter. But I think it is illustrative of a mindset in the current British government that somehow that you man up against this virus and you push out and there's some sort of fake war that can be waged against it by sort of a bigger, more manly, robust British administration.
Like the Desimali quote, you can just be one of the lads.
You know, it's all nonsense. You know, the virus doesn't know if you're British or robust or what you're cowering or doesn't care, by the way, you know. Yeah. It'll just sneak up and get you.
Yeah. Tony O'Brien has a piece talking about how leadership has really mattered and, you know, the UK and US leadership at the start of this really mattered in a negative way. And it does make me think, because like the Boris Johnson is still waving, like has still huge popularity. They don't link in the UK. They don't seem to be linking what's actually happening on the ground. You know, this week, bins not being collected, supermarkets, shelves being emptied out, all of that stuff. They don't link their daily, you know, problems with politics anymore, because it's a game that's played by, you know, privileged boys out, you know, down in London. And so I do wonder if that's a change that has happened over the last maybe 5 to 10 years, that, you know, politics isn't seen as, you know, something that lands on people's everyday lives, and it has changed their perception of what it is.
Speaking of that disconnect, a lot of people haven't necessarily drawn links between our heat wave and the dramatic floods in Eastern and Central and Eastern Europe, possibly on foot of the hot weather that we've had in Ireland in the last couple of days, but also because of the dramatic flooding that we've seen in the continent in the last couple of days. And also some of it linked to billionaires taking vanity trips to space, written in today's papers. Sinead, I'll start with yourself because there's a reasonable amount written about it. Anything that jumps out for you in the papers?
Yeah, for me, Colin Murphy in the Sunday Independent jumps out, probably as a editor of a publication, because he's talking about the media's responsibility here when we're talking about the coverage of weather events like the flooding or even like our heat wave this week, that we should be connecting them to climate change. We, you know, we should be responsible and giving information to readers and watchers about why this is happening. And he uses an example from RTE that during the week that the headline said, "Too soon to say floods linked climate change experts."
Whereas it's a view not shared by most other experts.
Yeah, most experts will say we have plenty of evidence to say that these extreme weather events that have become much more common, you know, like, and say for our own heat wave, The 10 hottest years, the 10 hottest periods of time have happened in the last, I think, 25 years, you know. So
yes.
we do have evidence that all of these things are linked to the warming of our planet. So it was a really interesting read to see how other places, he said, like in 10 stories that he read on the heat wave on RT News website between July 4th and yesterday morning, there were just two brief references to climate change. And this was in great contrast to what he saw in Britain, where the BBC, Guardian and The Times all at least had cursory references, even if they didn't go into it full depth. But I do think as an editor, then there is obviously a responsibility, but there's also a difficulty. And he goes on to like explain this in the piece as well, of like, how do you get people to engage with it when actually it is kind of one of those things that sometimes you want to just close your eyes to and walk straight ahead and, you know, not quite, you know, get onto space travel with Richard Branson. But how to make it like informative and palpable is something that, you know, we will all have to grapple with, like you as a broadcaster, me in print.
Well, I mean, I've had a little bit of experience of this during the week because I tweeted once or twice about some of the Met Air and weather warnings. And you do get people coming back and saying, why aren't you explicitly linking this to climate change? Which is, you could argue that it's maybe outside of the scope of just sharing the hard facts of a weather warning from Met Air, but you can also understand why people think it's a worthy point to make. Jared, I wonder what you make of the fact that so many media reports aren't including specific links to climate change.
It's just part, I suppose, of agnosticism about the whole thing. But I think what will be apparent within months here, as we have climate budgets for the first time.
Yes, as signed into law this week.
As the tough love really begins, as it leaves the fuzzy phase of legislating and gets into the brutally difficult part of downsizing carbon budgets in specific industries and sectors, there is going to be brutal sectoral war on the ground.
Well, for those who don't understand the premise of carbon budgets, I think the name might give the game away, but this is provided for under the Climate Action Act as it now is, which was signed into law by President Higgins this week. So this is the idea that government departments, in the same way that they're given a monetary budget and you're told to spend that however you like, they're basically now going to be told you are allowed to produce this amount of emissions.
So we want to have our carbon emissions by 2030. The climate change council.
It's kind of interchangeable austerities, really.
Different austerities will draft this for government. Government will consider, government will submit to the Oireachtas. And that is the moment that this aspiration crystallizes into action. And much of that action will be very difficult. It will be expensive. It will be displacing of vested interests, of people, of jobs, of companies. And it will, I think, be really challenging for the Green Party, for the other two parties in government, and wait for the instantaneous going offside of almost every other political party. Because, of course, while we're sort of in favour of that in general, don't you know, this is wrong because of that.
Yeah.
So you're always in favour of the principle, but there's always concerns about the practice.
But there's something wrong with this, and therefore
you can pick it apart quite easily. And know that these people have to be reminded for this reason, or you can't do it to those people because they're not the worst. And you know this always
you can't
comes
reduce
up.
The dairy herds.
You know, why are we worried about these when these people are worse? You know, we know, you know, agriculture, transport, and the energy demand are the three worst things. You'll see those all point to each other in the next while, particularly agriculture pointing to transport. And then you'll have people saying, well, look at China, look at America, look at everywhere else. Why do we have to be leaders? And I think, you know, there's been countless columns written about that.
And if you look at a decade-old project, the North-South Interconnector, which is, by the way, the only all-island institution that the DUP is actually for, it owes its origin to the last time a decade ago Eamon Ryan was Minister for Energy. And what it does, in theory, because it hasn't been built, it has enabled a massive onsourcing onto the grid of wind power, which can then be distributed island-wide, which then greens our grid, creates more green electricity, which is then used by industries as green fuel rather than carbon fuel. And a decade later, it hasn't happened because every trick in the book and every political shenanigan has delayed it year after year after year.
I don't know how many different government reviews there has been into planning or whether
you can
underground it.
There's another one ongoing at the moment, and I've lost count too. Apparently this is the review to end all reviews, but there have been so many in the past, who knows?
But I'm from Meath, and I know that a lot of people around my native neck of the woods are seriously concerned about it being overgrounded because of the visual aspect of it all, maybe not fully appreciating that it's not always a guaranteed technology you can put it underground, or that every place you have an interface between overground and underground, you have to build a giant transformer station that can convert the power from one sort to another, and it's all very difficultly done. Sinead, I wonder when the rubber does hit the road, although I suppose it'll have to be won't have to be rubber in future, they'll need something a little bit more sustainable, that this will feel to some people like it's austerity revisited again, because it's very difficult to have this headline notion of needing to cut your emissions by X percent year on year, 7% year on year, whatever it is, but also to do that in a way that doesn't feel like it's making people's lives materially more difficult.
Yeah, and we will have to make our lives more difficult. We have got way too used to having way too many conveniences, and you know, the Amazonification of like what we're used to in the world, that will have to change on, you know, a personal level. But you know, putting personal responsibility on this isn't enough. It has to change at a state level. And that's why the arguments that Ireland shouldn't be a leader are kind of silly, because everyone needs to be a leader for you know, us not to have to go with Bezos and Branson and Musk to space, you know, to be one of Musk's 1,000 Einsteins.
What I was going to ask about, because if people think that, you know, people will find it very difficult to get on board and to make personal sacrifices when they see what are almost universally seen as vanity projects by billionaires burning a catastrophic amount of fossil fuels to go into space for a few minutes in some sort of giant willy waving contest, frankly, against each other to decide who has a bigger rocket than the other. Like, it's going to be very difficult to get people on board, Jared, the idea that you're going to have to maybe pay for a glass deposit scheme or little micro things like that, if they see others who have the same economic power as several small states burning up fossil fuels so they could be weightless for 4 minutes.
And, you know, the very rich are, you know, nowadays in a globalised world beyond the reach of most governments. So it's much more difficult to do something about than to complain about it, by the way. And it comes down to Sinead's point that our lifestyles, you know, everything that's in and out of our fridge and everything that wraps, everything that's in and out of our fridge, our dry cleaning, and I could go on and on. We soak up the good out of the earth, hour by hour, day by day, for our lifestyles. And there's very few of us really understand the extent of that or are prepared to walk back from it.
Sinead, final thoughts for yourself before we wrap up?
I think with the, as you said, the willy waving competition between the lads in state, one of the things I think that it has brought is that the papers do have a lot more climate change discussion in them. I have heard a lot more climate change discussion since they've happened. So maybe it has had a, you know, crystallizing impact for opposite reasons. You know, Richard Branson got very little coverage, which as a, you know, publicist, he probably hated that people actually didn't care that he got to the edge of space. There was a little bit more for Bezos, a lot of it negative, probably still too much. We probably saturated people with images of it. And, you know, that probably is enough to, you know, massage their egos and get them to continue on. But I do think that it actually engendered conversations just amongst ordinary people about like, okay, this is actually crazy. We can't ravage Earth and go and look for somewhere else to inhabit in space like Musk is trying to do. We actually have to mine this planet.
The context of us trying to implement our carbon budgets here next year, there will have been a German election in September. As of now, the Christian Democrats and the Greens seem set to be that government. It could all fall apart, obviously. But if the Greens are in government in Germany, post-Brexit, the Germans are much more important. That influence would permeate European policy much more deeply as well.
French presidential election comes too. I'm not seeing the Greens going to win power there, but it could be interesting to see what direction they go. We are well over time. Thanks to both of you for coming in this morning. Jared Howland, public affairs consultant and columnist at the Sunday Times, and Sinead O'Carroll, editor of the journal.ie.